listening to the Nerds Assemble podcast.
Welcome to Nerds Assemble episode 143. I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
Okay, we're sans an Emily this week, so we are pretty much the Paul podcast.
Yay!
Paulcast.
The PPs.
Yeah, Paulcast. And this week we're going to be talking about brand loyalty. So, who wants to start? I think you've definitely got something to say about that, Retroid.
Ooh, no.
Never.
Well, let's see. What would you want to go for? Manufacturing, or you know, like game brand, or maybe TV, like you know, sci-fi series.
Ooh,
because I've been burnt on all of them.
Okay. Maybe we should start with sci-fi series.
There we go. Star Trek.
So, what really burnt you about that?
Shite films.
Fair enough, yeah.
Mostly. And huge chunks of Voyager, which I thought were crap. And
which ones in particular, though, movie-wise?
Oh, well, let's see. I like...
Search for Spock.
No, that was shite.
That's what I mean. You got burned by that.
Motion Picture was good. Wrath of Khan was great. Search for Spock was shit. Voyage Home was shit. Final Frontier was shit.
But it picked up a little bit with Final Frontier. I can still watch that.
Final Star Trek V, where they go and meet God's head. That shoots lasers at them.
Better than Search for Spock, easily.
I'm really not sure about that.
I'd rather watch that than Search for Spock. Definitely.
Undiscovered Country. There we go.
That.
Oh, of the original Star Trek films, before they went to Next Generation, there are three good ones, and that's Motion Picture, Wrath of Khan, and Undiscovered Country.
Hmm. Yeah.
Chuck the rest of them in the sea.
In the bin.
What about the next-gen ones?
Oh, well, Generations was okay. And then First Contact was quite good. But then you had Insurrection.
I didn't really get into much of Insurrection.
I rewatched that recently, and it was just, oh, this is worse than I remember it. By a fair whack.
Nemesis was alright then.
Nemesis, which they remade for that Into Darkness. Because it was not Wrath of Khan that they remade. They just remade Nemesis. It was just a bit crap.
Okay. So what did you think of Enterprise?
It started off okay and then wandered off.
See, I actually found the first season quite difficult to get into. But then I think halfway through the second and third season, when you're getting more into the threat on the Earth, that was quite more interesting.
The issue I had with that is that they kept tying it together with this getting messages from the future.
Yeah.
And it's just, stop with time travel shit. Can you not just have something that's happening there and then?
Yeah. That's true.
Hmm.
It did have some interesting characters. Trip was cool.
So yeah, a few other characters were okay. And I said a few podcasts back that I recently rewatched all the Alternate Universe episodes.
Yeah.
And the Enterprise episodes came off quite decently. And they were one of the, even though they did resort to bloody time travel again. But at least it made sense, because in that one it was a ship from the Kirk era, which of course it would be from their future, and that meant they could just fly around kicking ass. And that's how the Earth Empire, Terran Empire, started off, because they had future technology and just went around blowing shit up.
So the question becomes, because it sounds like a lot of the later stuff that Star Trek has kind of done is quite bad, in your opinion. So what kind of brings you back to it repeatedly as a franchise?
It's Star Trek.
There's just that hope, isn't there? There's just the hope they'll be redeemed. And you'll be brought back into the glory days.
Yeah, I'm really not holding out much hope for what I'll call Star Trek 3 of the reboots.
See, I quite like the reboots.
I thought the first one was all right, and then I thought Into Darkness was just poor.
I've got hopes for 3 with them starting the whole 5-year exploration into space and stuff. That'd be cool.
Now it's different people in charge, and Simon Pegg is
co-writing it.
Yeah, co-writing it. I've got a little bit of hope that it'll be, you know, be able to pull it back out the fire. But
I was reading the other day as well. They're talking about they're trying to put new aliens into it rather than Klingons and Romulans because they feel like it's been done to death. So they want to try and bring new aliens into it, which will be interesting.
Hmm.
Now, I was actually reading about some of the backstory, sort of expanded storyline to the original, you know, the original reboot, if you see what I mean. God, when you're talking about time travel and reboots, and it gets a little bit confusing, past and future tense. But they were saying that the whole mix got really screwed up by Nero coming back in time, because that meant that his mining ship had future technology and the Klingons got hold of that. Even though that's never really mentioned in the film. I think it's kind of mentioned that he's been in prison, but there's a whole subplot which was just cut out of the cinema release.
Wow.
And it's there as a deleted scene of him and his crew getting captured by the Klingons and held on I think it's Rua Pente, which is the prison planet from Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
And there are all these things where it's not just the actual Enterprise and Kirk and Spock timeline that's been screwed up. It's it's the wide galactic area that has been screwed up by this timeline. And that's kind of more interesting, and they could do stuff with that so that the balance of power could be quite different.
Definitely.
Well, there's no Vulcan for Star, isn't there?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a change, isn't it?
Although,
just a little bit.
Although saying that, I mean, with the next generation era, did have Vulcans every now and again, but it wasn't like such a major kind of plot thing. So it does make me wonder, because theoretically, would the Romulans actually kind of take a bit of a rise as well from the fall of Vulcan?
You'd have thought so.
You see, putting on my geek hat, which I very rarely take off anyway.
That's what Nero was hoping after all, isn't it?
Yeah, there's the whole thing that the Vulcans were the first species that Earth encountered with warp drive technology when they got noticed. Then they kind of guided Earth, because after all they're the older species and society and tech. So they sort of guided them, and that's covered in Enterprise. And then of course the Vulcans become one of the founding planets of the Federation, but most of that's already happened when it comes to the reboot. So they could do a lot of interesting things, but the problem I have is it's such a wide fandom, wide universe, with so many things that they could change and tweak, but they've only got these bloody films.
Yeah, absolutely. So if they were to spin it off into a TV series, they could do some amazing things with it. I mean,
they could do some really interesting things with a TV series.
What would have happened if somehow it actually affected the Cardassian occupation of Bajor, for example?
Yeah, there's whole things that go on in the Star Trek universe that it could all be screwed up, because after all, the Klingons are quite a large empire. And if they've suddenly got future technology, then they're going to be screwing all sorts of things up. They might not enter into, because in the original timeline, in the original series,
hmm.
and I've read some of the novels on this as well. Again, nerd heart. The reason that in when it comes to the late original series, the Klingons and Romulans are working together, apart from the studio is fucking about with the scripts.
Yeah.
So they're just putting bad guys together because that's what TV series did. The canon version for that was that the Romulans had technology that the Klingons didn't, but the Klingons had numbers.
So makes sense.
They shared technology and arms and capabilities and things like that, so they could, face off against the Federation.
Well, theoretically, that means that if the Klingons add both the numbers and the technology from, mm-hmm.
So the Romulans could get wiped out. They could, do with that, but whether they actually will or not, and again, with the limitations of series.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be that in the films that they could do, all kinds of new things like this, instead of going off in that direction, like they did in the original timeline, they go at a 90 degree angle.
Yeah.
Into the galaxy and just go in a different direction and, do different things instead. And
They could actually come across the Delta Quadrant before Voyager.
Possibility, but they wouldn't necessarily have kind of approached the Borg.
True.
Yeah, so there's all sorts that could go on there, but I think they probably won't because it's just sort of... And Paramount's new owners seem to think that Star Trek is just a big whiz-bang, shiny cash cow.
Yeah.
Like Transformers.
But I mean, the stupid thing
about—that's another disappointment.
Yeah. Yes. The stupid thing about the Star Trek situation is that there's so many Trekkies out there, and there's so much support for an absolute devotion to Star Trek, and what's being blocked from being produced more rights management in essence.
Yeah, there's a whole TV rights nightmare when it comes to actually doing it, and I understand that, but. It's just a massive pin in the ass.
Because they have just got a new series off. Well, it's going to be a web series, I think, but on Kickstarter, they Renegades.
Oh, yeah. I've heard
that. And that's premiering, I think it's in August for the backers.
Yeah, I've watched that progress and I've seen trailers and such. I'm really not sure about how good that's going to be.
I'm not sure, but I'll still be watching it because it's Star Trek.
I know there's, I think it's a fan kind of. Fandom one, which was like Star Trek Axanar or something.
Axanar.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. That one did seem quite cool. I think I watched. Not sure whether it was like in episodes or whatnot, but I did watch like a YouTube video on it, and it's
was it Prelude really... to Axanar,
which yeah,
is
yeah,
their
I think
kind
that's
of
it.
Teaser, but it's a reasonable length. It's about half an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour.
Absolutely, in like interview style with several captains and stuff.
But it looks really nice. And that's one that I'm really am looking forward to. Whereas a lot of the other things, when you can see that they are fan productions, and they're trying, bless them. But
so, going from one side of the sci-fi pun to the other, Star Wars brand loyalty to Star Wars.
Yeah, I'm quite loyal to Star Wars.
A New Hope. Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi and the new ones.
Plus the books. Some really good books.
And
some good comics. Yeah.
And the Knights of the Old Republic games.
Oh, yes. Knights of the Old Republic.
There we go. Those are the only ones that exist.
Oh, dear.
Because even though we did that Machete special,
You
download right now, thumbs up.
Absolutely.
Cheesy smile. even though we did that, the Machete Order with, including episodes 2 and 3, which don't exist, they were still bad.
Okay.
They were more palatable, but
because I can actually quite happily watch those characters in Clone Wars, which is a cartoon on Cartoon Network, and I quite enjoy it.
I remember seeing a Clone Wars, animated film at the cinema the one time, and that just seemed really, really bad. It was absolutely terrible. Like, Anakin stopped a battle and sat on, like, this thing and had tea. What?
Okay.
Yeah. I remember that and being like, what? Then they introduced another character which was meant to be... well, I think she's part of the series anyway, but she was meant to be like Anakin Skywalker's, you know, kind of disciple.
Oh, apprentice, yeah. So
apprentice, yeah.
And yes.
Yeah, she cool seemed character. All right. And
she was
yeah.
a really good character.
But, yeah, nothing really happened.
It's Ahsoka or something, isn't it?
Mm. I think. But
that sounds about right. It still baffles me that there hasn't been a TV series. As in, live action.
Live action. No, it's weird, isn't it?
Well, they could do it nowadays because of the technology.
Oh, give Disney time.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. Let them run out of steam with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Hmm. So, I mean...
But saying that, the new series, Rebels, Rebels that's on Disney XD, that's quite good as well.
See, it's weird, but I think it's because Lucas doesn't have... direct control over them, so therefore you can actually get good writers.
Ahsoka Tano, that's the one.
Whereas, of course, with the movies, because they're Lucas's baby, he managed to completely shit on my childhood with three films.
Okay, so my next question, right, because there seems to be, at least in kind of the media, this kind of Star Trek versus Star Wars, you know, kind of fan battle and whatnot.
I've kept hearing that.
Why? I don't understand.
I don't
why.
Know, because so far as I'm concerned, it's sci-fi, so that's cool.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I like them both. I've never got, oh no, you must choose Star Wars or Star Trek.
You're either one of us or you're against us.
I don't know, maybe because I could just, you know, when I was growing up, I was just watch anything I bloody could that was sci-fi.
I mean, I always preferred Star Trek, but it's not like I'm against Star Wars fans.
Well, one of the reasons I think I liked Star Trek more was that there was just more of it.
Okay,
definitely more of it, wasn't there? Because you had the TV and the films.
Yeah, like, so you had hours of Star Trek, and then of course they did Next Generation. Whereas with Star Wars, it was you had three films.
Mm.
And the books.
I can kind of see that. But, with me, Star Trek, I didn't... Obviously, I wasn't live watching to watch the original series.
Well, neither was I.
Even on the repeats and whatnot, so
bastard. I caught it on rerun, so I didn't watch the original airing.
So, I mean, I started on Next Generation, I think I remember when I first got into it, first started watching it with my dad. Riker actually had a beard. So kind of going through the entire series and then kind of getting videotapes of, you know, so like some of the first episodes and whatnot, it looked really, really weird when Riker didn't have a beard.
Yeah.
Really, really weird. But
Encounter was... far point.
Yeah.
Riker. That was just season one where he didn't have a beard.
Mm. But I mean, one of the things that I like about Star Trek is that it does focus a lot on the technology, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and one of the reasons I've always liked Star Trek is the technology makes sense within its own boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they do, you know, later on tend to do the have you reversed the polarity.
Yeah.
You know, type bollocks, type MacGuffins, but it's always all the you know, the transporter can do this.
Yeah.
And it has these limits. Phasers can do this. Torpedoes can do this. Warp can do this. But it's not a magic go from what here to there instantaneously or anything like that.
No. And I like the fact that most of their stories actually revolved around the technology not working correctly as well. You know, holodecks will break down. You know, warp drives will do something weird. Other stuff as well.
There's one of the, you know, behind the scenes bits where it's is it Seth MacFarlane who does Family Guy?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's a massive Star Trek fan, And I just recently watched the season 3 Blu-ray set. And he does a sit-down with several of the writers, including Ronald D. Moore, who started on the third season of Star Trek Next Generation and, of course, went on to Battlestar Galactica.
Okay.
Yes.
But he started off there. He sent in fan scripts and, you know, things like that, and eventually got, you know, a chance to, you know, write a few episodes. Hmm. So that's how he got started off on TV.
Hmm.
But, he's talking to them there, and they had the whole thing of, oh, yeah, the transporter going wrong, or the holodeck malfunctions.
Yes.
And that was a running joke for them.
Hmm.
Well, I'm not sure about holodeck malfunctions, but I think they did say that they got clever with the way things could go wrong with the holodeck, but it wouldn't be the holodeck going wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so it would be...
characters suddenly appearing out of nowhere, so to speak.
Well, like Moriarty.
Mm.
Oh, Moriarty was
that. Oh, that was a clever one.
Because that was all in what Geordi asked the computer to do.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the computer or the holodeck going wrong. It was...
The instructions.
It was the instructions.
Yeah.
Or...
Barclay. I can't remember what was the problem with A Fistful of Datas. Do you remember that? Where it was like the interface between Data and the ship that kind of caused the holodeck to somehow spawn Datas everywhere.
You know, I can't remember. I can't remember what the reasoning for that one was, but I do remember that it wasn't one of my favourite episodes.
No. Oh dear.
That's when it was definitely.
No, because kind of looking at some of the undertones for like the original series, and there'd always be like this kind of either going back in time or meeting Greek gods or, you know, these type of entities and whatnot. And I could see that reflected a lot more in the first season of The Next Generation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It just seemed to grow up like after that. But yeah, it was that first episode or season.
In a way, that was the only template they had.
Mm.
So, yeah, definitely in the first season of Next Generation, they do tend to go to the planets with the strange colour sky and the polystyrene rocks.
Mm.
Every now and again. Instead of, you know, later on, they do actually make an effort of, you know, it looking slightly different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in Stargate, you get every single character, you know, in SG-1, every single planet they go to, the characters always end up in Canada. The Canadian forest.
Crazy.
So yeah, I keep on intending to watch Stargate or SG-1 on Netflix, because they've got like all 10 seasons on there. And I also know that they've got Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe as well. But it's I kind of don't want to do it at the same time, because I know that it's going to be quite a long, you know, quite a long length.
It's going to be very...
I mean, this is like the prime of the American series as well, when they're like 24 episodes long.
Yeah.
Although usually half of those are a bit naff, but...
So, well, Stargate SG-1 was all... It evolved. You could see it evolve from just a planet of the week... And then, of course, they went through all the Gauld stuff, and it just sort of developed. And then, of course, it ended off with the was it Ori? And that wasn't exactly brilliant, but at least they were trying new and different things. Mm. So I quite enjoyed the series as a whole. But yeah, it's very definitely a sort of a pulp sci-fi TV series.
But I mean, when it comes to like Stargate and stuff, you know, you don't generally tend to have the same kind of hatred for other sci-fi shows that, you know, some hardcore Trekkies or hardcore Star Wars fans have, apparently.
Yeah, it's always been apparently.
Yeah.
I've never
Maybe it's just like the media portrayal that's, you know, kind of wanting to, you know, go, nerd fight!
I think it's one of those where you just get into an argument on the internet.
Yeah.
Or some people get into an argument on the internet and say, which is better?
Yeah.
And you have the boring one, which is me, saying, well, they both have different things going for them. I like them both.
Hmm.
And then you have the arseholes who always have to, you know, have something win or lose.
Well, it's not just that, but they also have to big up, like, say, for example, a Star Trek fan or Trekkie would, of this ilk anyway, would try and big up, you know, all the best things about Star Trek and just topping them or comparing them with all the worst things about Star Wars and, you know, completely unevenly match it.
And then Lucas comes along years later and, you know, gives them more ammo for the worst of Star Wars.
Oh, dear. Yeah, but I mean, it's kind of weird how you have that with, you know, kind of Star Trek versus Star Wars, but you don't necessarily have that with things like Babylon 5.
No. Although there was a bit of a, when it first came out and Deep Space Nine was announced, there's a bit of a, oh no, they're ripping off Star Trek, but that's, do you know what I mean?
Which is kind of interesting because technically Straczynski, I think
he'd already written it beforehand.
Exactly.
He actually
approached the creators of Star Trek to actually do a spin-off series. They turned around and said no, and then did DS9.
Yeah, which I thought was just very coincidental. So what the hell is the point of doing a sci-fi series where everyone's sitting on a station and doesn't go anywhere and everything comes to them? That would be a stupid idea.
Not just that, but by having to kind of balance like religion and politics in the same space, like constantly as well. I mean, with Star Trek Next Generation, you'd have like diplomats kind of visiting the ship, or, you know, Picard going to a planet somewhere and kind of dealing with something. But they always manage to kind of get out of there. Whereas, you know, with kind of Babylon 5 and DS9, they've constantly got people coming in and people are actually living on the station. It's not just like going through or visiting. You actually have, you know, kind of a situation actually on the station to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was one of the issues that the writers had, because Gene Roddenberry on Next Generation was adamant that humanity had reached this utopian panacea and had no conflict. And there was no sexism, no racism, no homophobias or anything like that. And, you know, humanity had sorted itself out and was awesome.
Yeah.
So the writers would come to them and say, well, what if we had this situation where, you know, this new crew member, you know, hates, you know, someone else and, you know, blah, 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 because of course it would be conflict and it's a way for them to, you know, get stories done.
Mm.
And Gene would be, no.
Actually,
that doesn't happen because everyone's awesome.
Actually, if you think about it, a lot of the problems from, like, Star Trek Next Generation actually stem from outside forces.
Exactly.
So, that actually makes sense.
And, of course, that's why with DS9 they had the Federation crew trying to integrate with Bajoran.
Mm.
Yep.
And everything being alien and, you know, having different systems. Because, by design, the Federation crew wouldn't be argumentative with each other.
No.
No.
So you had to have everything from the outside. And then, of course, there was the whole Marquee thing later on.
Oh, yeah.
Where, as a quick recap, there were members of the Federation that disagreed with a deal the Federation did to hand over some planets and systems,
including Bajor,
to the Cardassians, to ensure there was peace. Mm. And, you know, they disagreed and defected, and they became the Marquis.
Not to mention, was it Section 6?
Yes,
like the shadow organization within Starfleet.
Yeah, there's a whole sordid history you know, ways to try and get, you know, more conflict in Star Trek. But before this becomes a Trek cast.
Yeah, it was feeling a little bit like that, but yeah.
Let's see other types of brand loyalty. Well, let's see. One of the most obvious would be hardware loyalty.
Mm. Yeah.
Brand loyalty when it comes to, you know, either computers,
consoles, phones.
Well, I mean, without getting into kind of video games consoles yet, I think with kind of TVs and general electrical equipment, I think there's a certain level of kind of, you know, that a certain brand is likely to be good or likely to last, and that's why you choose it.
Zanussi or GTFO?
I mean, I have a couple of Samsung televisions, you know.
I won't have any of that Smeg shit in my kitchen. I'll cut you.
Nothing wrong with a Smeg fridge.
Bit smelly there. Sorry.
Oh, I had to. You had to, didn't you?
Yes.
Sorry, carry on.
But yeah, brand loyalty has always been a little bit weird. But well, let's see. You know, back in me and Cookie's days, because we're old bastards.
Oh yeah. Okay. This should be fun. Cheers.
Commodore, Spectrum, and Amstrad.
Oh yeah. The beginning.
Here we go.
Is that technically the beginning of the console wars, or is that?
Well, kind of. It depends, because of course in America had the Atari VCS and ColecoVision, yes, and stuff like that.
Hmm. We had the BBC Micro.
No, teachers' kids had the BBC Micro.
Oui, I had a BBC Micro.
Now, let's see, was your dad or mum a lawyer or a teacher?
No, they owned a little grocery shop. And they used the BBC Micro for the accounts.
Ah, see, that actually does make sense. But yeah, you are one of the few people I've known who's had a BBC Micro who wasn't literally the son or daughter of a teacher.
No,
those are the only people I knew. True. There was a boy called Nigel. I mean, there you go. The name should say everything. In my primary school, who was the son of a lawyer. He had a BBC Micro. Which meant that it kept going up to teacher and getting extra time. Because he'd bring stuff from home and say, you little wanker. But, yeah, there was a whole Commodore 64, you know, Spectrum 1-8, you know, 48K 1-8. And, you know, the Amstrad CPC line of computers.
Yes.
And, you know, most people had Spectrums. There are a few people who had Commodore 64s. And I knew one boy in school who had a CPC.
I didn't realize we knew you. I knew you at school. What's going on?
But for some weird reason, down south from Facebook groups, I mean, it seemed to be that more people had CPCs.
That's because they worked.
That's because they could be rented out to small apartments. Seriously, Amstrad CPCs were huge. You could beat a man to death with an Amstrad CPC.
True. This is true.
I had a Spectrum when I was a kid.
You had to buy the cassette tape player separately as well. And then you had to attach that and make it even bigger.
On the plus side, because they were actually cassettes, you could copy the games.
Oh, you pirate.
Never knew that.
I never did that. I didn't have a twin tip deck. Hi-fi.
To be fair, no, I never actually did that. I did have some blank tapes, but that was for road processing and storing files on.
Used most of mine for public domain stuff and backing up games that I bought on tape onto disc.
Never even thought of that, to be fair. I mean, I even remember there was a magazine that you could subscribe to, or a video game club. And every month they'd send you a game and charge you 13 quid for the privilege. Yes. Yeah, I signed up for it and soon regretted that. God.
Because it was a model that continued for years, and I remember that, because it was that you'd have a selection of really good games to start off with, and it would be pick five for a fiver.
Yes.
And it would be, oh, I love those because they're good. And then they would send you the game of the month, which would be shit.
Yep.
And there would be twice another game. Cost. Yeah, and it would just, everything after that was just awful.
That's how I ended up with Friday the 13th.
Never mind. But let's see. So, you know, brand loyalty with them. When it came to the 16-bit computers coming out, I remember Commodore made the Commodore 64. So pretty much all the Commodore 64 runners went to the Commodore Amiga. And a hell of a lot of the Spectrum owners, because Sinclair didn't do a next generation machine because the QL was rubbish and didn't count. they went to the Atari ST because the primary reason for that was it was slightly cheaper and it wasn't Commodore.
I actually went to the Master System.
Oh, yeah. The Master System was quite popular over here because I think it probably got released before the Nintendo Entertainment System. The Nintendo Entertainment System came out late.
Okay,
it was stupid. And then, of course, you had the issue where if you were using 8-bit computers still, the games would cost about, you know, $9.99 at most.
Yeah.
And then, oh, you can have a Nintendo game for only £50.
Yeah.
Or I could have 5 games instead.
I can't remember, you could actually pick them up in your newsagent as well.
Oh, yeah.
A little carousel.
Yeah, you had budget games, so you had stuff that you know, cost £2.
Codemasters, Dizzy Collection.
Heck, you had ones, I think it was the Quattro Collection, where you'd have 4 games on one tape.
One tape, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. So you had all of those to choose from.
Mm.
And then, of course, so, you know, the 16 bits came along, and it was pretty much in the UK. It was the Commodore Amiga and the Atari ST. And then when it came to consoles, you had, most of the Master System owners went over to the Mega Drive.
Mega Drive.
The Mega Drive was hosting quite nice arcade conversions. And then, of course, the Super Nintendo came along because, to my mind, the original Nintendo didn't make much of a splash over here.
I had one.
And that's when it began. We can trace it back to that point.
Now, does anybody else remember something about if you collect enough Walker's packets or something like that, and cut out the squares, then you can get send it off for Nintendo or something. Vaguely remember something about that.
Oh, there are a few deals like that, but I can't remember specifically.
Yeah, probably need about 300 packets or something at least.
I remember when I went to college in '91. That one of my college mates had an NES and he bought the Star Wars game, you know, that came out in it, and that was quite good. Mm. It did cost him over £50.
Yeah.
And that was insane.
Mm.
So, you know, that was... And then, of course, the rest of us were buying Amiga games and such, and they were costing about 30, 35 quid maximum. Installed.
Yep.
So... Why on earth would you? And then, of course, there was, you know, then it went mostly PC because, you know, Atari, you know, went under and, you know, Commodore went under. So it went, you know, mostly either PC or it was games consoles. And then, of course, you had the whole Nintendo Sega thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until Sony came along with the PlayStation and that sort of threw everything out the water. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it just seems to be, there's a weird attachment that people have to, if they've mostly had PlayStations, they will get another PlayStation.
Mm.
Yes.
And if they've mostly had, say, Xboxes, they will mostly get the next Xbox. Even if there's no real advantage to going on to the next one. Because especially with these ones, there was no backwards compatibility.
But the thing with, you know, kind of this type of brand loyalty is you know, you've got a group of games that are usually made exclusively for that, you know, console that you can play, which kind of makes
sense
more so than...
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But buying, an Xbox for multi-platform games doesn't make sense to me in this generation. No. Just like it didn't make... sense for the, you know, for buying a PS3 and then going multi-format with the last generation. Why would you do that to yourself? Because most of them were just, they were worse in one way or another.
I think it comes down to how comfortable you are with the brand. You've had that brand for X amount of years, so you've become to trust that brand and you become a little bit more like an old friend, isn't it?
Rather defensive of it. I mean, I find that I'm usually quite defensive of Nintendo because I've always kind of grown up with Nintendo consoles. And
yeah.
You see, in a way, yeah, that has been the kind of there in the background every now and again. I've picked up on it. There's a vibe every now and again. You know, you go, I hadn't noticed that before.
To be fair,
I wonder if you've played those Zelda games on the Game Boy Color.
I used to be the same as Sega, though, when I was a kid. It was always Sega.
Again, it's the you have to pick the winner.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So people get more
competitive.
Competitive, and they need to prove that they haven't made.
Maybe it's just because it's like the big two. I mean, like with sci-fi, as we were talking about earlier, it's like Star Trek versus Star Wars, and that's probably because they were the two biggest groups.
But then with that, it's going to be films or TV stuff, and they're going to be, you know, you're not going to need a specific brand Star Wars player.
No.
No.
To be able to watch them. It's going to be on whatever format. Mm. You know, it's going to be on the TV that's in your room. You're not going to have to buy a new TV to see the other.
No.
Or, you know, watch the discs. Yeah. So,
although saying that, I would like an R2-T2 projector.
Yeah, I've seen ones. I've seen ones that people have made as
actually,
well.
Actually, it does make me wonder, because of, you know, exclusivity and whatnot. When it came to VHS versus Betamax, were there any kind of titles that you found were on one but not the other, at least at the time?
Not that I can remember.
So I do remember like the similar thing being with Blu-ray versus HD DVD.
I think it was definitely there with Blu-ray and HD DVD. Mm. But I think I don't know with Betamax and VHS. I think it was just down to whether they produced them, the copies. And they were available for people to, you know, to rent out or buy, and that's what it came down to. And there's bound to have been some studios or some distributors who were only going to be able to afford
VHS. To support,
you know, the biggest market, which would have been VHS.
Hmm.
But yeah,
have there been any brands that you've basically fell out of love with? Like, not just kind of recognizing that the latest stuff is nowhere near as good, but actually actively turned around and said, right, well, I'm just not bothering with them anymore.
There's bound to be some.
Yeah, no, they...
Or is that always going to be like a little place in your heart, you know, that brand's going to, you know, just stay there forever?
I mean...
Apple. No, seriously, I fell out of love with Apple.
Okay.
That's because they're an appliance company now.
No, I must admit, I wouldn't go back to having an iPhone again. Never.
Interesting.
In a million years.
What is that?
Crap battery life. The fact that if I want a ringtone, I've got to spend half an hour to actually convert it, put it into their own format, cheekily get it onto the iPhone. Mess about with it a little bit more and actually get it to recognise it. Either that, or I can pay Apple the money for the ringtone, which to me seems a bit daft.
Apple fans are one of the worst.
You know, it's just closed off. I've had the Apple, I had the original iPhone, 3G, 3GS, and 5. So I've always stuck with them, but then I went to Android about 2 years ago.
Okay.
And because of how open it is and how much I can physically actually do with it, I just wouldn't go back. And that's purely because of the way I use my phone, I think.
Okay.
It just suits my needs more tenderly. There's nothing wrong with the iPhone, but it's just there's nothing amazing about it either anymore, I don't think, personally. Cameras are 4 years behind.
I'm going to resist the urge to kick the boot into Apple.
You're going to resist the urge?
Yeah. Well, not that much. Apple do a very good job of selling underpowered stuff for massively more than they're worth.
Mm.
Because they convince people that what they're getting is something special.
Mm.
But it is all about the brand, doesn't it? Mm. That Apple logo...
It is all about the brand.
I mean,
that's where they've really scored really well.
Yeah, well, when it comes to Apple, you know, I've heard you know, people who are real Apple fans just turn around and say something along the lines of, "Oh, well, it just works."
Tell that to an IT support friend of mine who had to try
absolutely
a Mac laptop working on their IT system, and it just would not fucking work.
No. I can imagine that would have been a nightmare getting it to talk to the server and that.
See, I would say Apple stuff works so long as it's talking to Apple stuff.
Yeah.
If it's talking to anything else, then they can, you know, whatever it is it's talking to can go to hell.
But I mean,
to be fair, for photo editing and video editing and sort of creative stuff like that, the Apple, because of the way it runs the memory in the background stuff, it does tend to enhance down, although Windows is slowly catching up. But for memory processor stuff, yeah, Apple is very clever how it allocates the RAM and everything else.
Mm. But once again, what we're seeing is a lot of stuff kind of straddling between Apple and kind of Microsoft.
Yeah.
So it a lot of times, any advantage is incredibly temporary.
Very temporary.
But of course, this doesn't.
It depends on what you're going to use it for.
But of course, this doesn't kind of take on to you know, any kind of brand loyalty type things. I've previously kind of searched around for like video editing jobs online and just kind of seen what they were, and I come across this one story of this guy that was actually approached to edit somebody's film, and you know, they kind of messaged each other and whatnot. And I think he had the right program, which was like Adobe Premiere or something like that. But yeah. He was using it on a PC rather than a Mac. And the filmmakers just suddenly turned around and said, "Oh, no, don't want you then." It's like,
wow.
What? Just because it's not working on a Mac, you...
Yeah,
it's just mind-boggling.
It is. It is very mind-boggling.
Just close the door. Right. When it comes to the whole brand loyalty and Apple thing, I think one of the things that might bite them in the ass is the watch.
Yeah.
I've seen far more negativity about that watch than I have about almost anything else they've done.
Mm. Definitely.
And it's been very enjoyable to watch.
Have you seen have you seen College Humor's like videos on YouTube about like kind of fake kind of Apple kind of advertisement, you know, it's like new feature of, you know, this phone is pretty much, it's a different power cord.
I've not seen those, yeah. But I have done the, No, I've seen the occasional, just make sure, I don't do these, so don't sue me. you know, the fake ones saying, oh yes, this new firmware update makes it waterproof.
Oh, those.
You cruel bastard. I really like that.
So how far do you think people should go with brand loyalty? Or should there be any brand loyalty at all?
I think there's knowing what a brand is like and being able to judge based on that. You know, like if you know, well, I remember Iowa being a cheap hi-fi brand.
Mm. Oh yeah,
in the 90s.
I had an Iowa hi-fi,
and you know, cool. You knew what you were getting pretty much. You know, and the same if you bought an Amstrad, not computer.
Yeah. Oh yeah, because so, if you wanted the
stand down cookie, stand down.
Well, but no, I was going to say, if you wanted the best hi-fi, you'd get a Wharfdale. If you couldn't afford that, you'd get an Iowa.
Yeah, but. When it comes to a lot of brands, they are very much of a muchness.
Yeah, they. It's not like when we were growing up where brands were different. You could tell the difference.
They're just nowadays, a variety with, you know, how to do the same kind of thing. Whereas, you know, if you're gonna pick up a Bose, it's gonna.
Yeah.
The fact that they don't have the price on the advert. It's going to be a little bit of an indication.
Absolutely. Yeah. There seems to be like this market for like high-end electrical stuff that sometimes does stuff, you know, like really, really well, but not necessarily different to other brands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, occasionally you do get, you know, stuff like Dyson, which do seem to try and innovate within their area, like with vacuums and fans and stuff.
And then you have everyone else trying to copy them in a slightly not quite copied,
copyrighted
way.
We don't have the ball, we have the square.
Yeah. And I mean, even those hand dryers and the men's loos, the Dyson ones.
Yeah.
And you get like the cheaper versions, which don't dry your hands as much.
Yeah. But let's see, brand loyalty. We touched on it a little bit earlier, but oh yeah, there's definitely a Nintendo thing going on there, isn't there? Isn't there, Paul?
Yes, for me.
Now, as a brand loyalty, it kind of makes more sense to me because I would say Nintendo are primarily a developer.
Yes.
So if you want Nintendo games, you're going to have to buy a Nintendo format. So yeah. I can understand that.
You say that I'd they're say, a developer, but to a certain extent... USP. But to a certain extent, Nintendo have also been responsible for some of the most iconic features on video games controllers. Say, for example, the D-pad or the shoulder buttons.
True.
So there's been kind of, you know, you can kind of see where they've kind of come from, you know, from that perspective. You know, they've always been, you know, kind of thinking about new ways to control stuff in new ways, really.
The D-pad was just a way to make a smaller controller, and it's just cursor keys in a slightly different, in an X shape rather than a T.
But I mean, the design of having literally just up, down, left, and right, though, kind of meant that it was easier to program for. I think I can't remember whether it was like an interview with one of the developers behind, you know, the original kind of NES controller, or whether it was like one of these Nintendo developer interviews or whatever.
Yeah.
But they kind of did illustrate just kind of the evolution of kind of what was going on between the video games themselves and the controllers. So, say for example, with F-Zero on the SNES. They actually had like the, you know, shoulder buttons in mind for being able to kind of nudge left and right without actually having to turn the entire ship.
Yeah. I think that when it comes to that, you know, those kinds of videos and those kinds of talks, they tend to ignore any outside influence.
Okay.
And big up their own. Because for a start, the late 70s at the Atari consoles had a standard joystick with a button. Now, all you could really say that, you know, Nintendo did, if it was in fact Nintendo who, you know, were the first to do it, was, and I don't think it was, I think it might have been Sega when it comes to you know, as in specifically games console. But they moved some of the buttons that were on the console onto the pad.
Yeah.
So when it comes to, oh, they invented the D-pad, it's like, in a sort of very roundabout way, but it's not like they suddenly decided, hey, instead of shouting at the screen and hoping to control it by psychic power, we thought we'd best put directions on the button on the controller. It's like, yeah. It's like, I remember seeing stuff about the Wii U when it came out, and this particular developer was saying, this is the first time there's ever been a console with a built-in screen. Vectrex says hi.
Yeah.
Game & Watch says hi.
Yeah,
and all these other formats that I played that had built-in screens.
Yeah.
So it's just, if you completely ignore anything that came beforehand and say, yeah, well, you know, we did this first, then... you did. But I've seen a hell of a lot of stuff, like health bars and double jump, being attributed to Nintendo games.
Really?
Yeah. And it's just, no, they were not the first ones to do it, because I remember playing a game on the Spectrum or the Commodore 64 from about 2 years earlier that did that. So just because it's the only one you were aware of, it doesn't mean that it originated from there.
Fair enough.
And I will hand on heart say, of course, that just because the first time I encountered a health bar in a game wasn't such and such, or like, you know, just to pluck one out there, Wizard's Lair on you know, the Commodore 64 and the, you know, the Specky. Just because that's the first time I encountered it doesn't mean it was the first time that actually existed. But yeah. Most of the time, when it's firsts that existed in Nintendo games, no, it didn't. I'll get off my soapbox. But yeah, so Nintendo as a developer, because it had to change from that, didn't it? Because when it came, you know, when it was the NES, Nintendo had a massive stranglehold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To all these developers like Konami and Capcom and such, you know, they were doing the games there. When it came to the Mega Drive and the Super Nintendo, suddenly there was a little bit more diversification. And things like the family policy that Nintendo had worked against it for some of the games that were being converted to it. Like the infamous case of Wolfenstein, where instead of Alsatians, that got changed to giant rats in the Super Nintendo. So it was just stupid.
I mean, I remember the Mortal Kombat one, which was basically where, you know, they had sweat flying everywhere rather than blood.
Yeah,
it was a bit weird.
The old thing of it was either sweat, or they changed it to green, so it would be like slime or something like that. That was a very common thing. And the Mega Drive suddenly became the cool one to have. Because you could play Mortal Kombat and it would have all the fatalities and it would have the blood flying everywhere.
Yeah.
So even though it might not look as good or might not sound as good as the Super Nintendo version, because the Super Nintendo was a nicer machine than the Mega Drive, it would have all these features that Nintendo were, oh no, you can't have that, because everything has to be suitable for family. So they had to relax that. And then, of course, this the PlayStation came along, and that attracted a lot of the developers, again, that were previously exclusive to Nintendo. So you suddenly had this split. And then, you know, since then, it's been hopping all over the place, and it's becoming harder and harder to be a single platform gamer. You more or less can't do it now.
Absolutely.
Because you know that if you're going to be, I mean, when it comes to the current crop, I'd say it's a little bit easier because you could pick one and most of the games are going to be coming out. There's not going to be, 100% cast iron.
No.
Certainty that this is going to be exclusive, apart from when it comes to Halo, that's not going to be on PlayStation. And Uncharted is not going to be on Xbox. But those are about the only things.
Well, for those two,
But when it comes to the Nintendo ones, Nintendo have been the developer, and they've had to concentrate and do more second party deals. So I've seen Nintendo fans get more and more rabid, would be the term I'd use, where people were insisting that Nintendo Land was the best thing they'd played in years.
It's a fun game, but the best thing? Wow.
Yeah, see what I mean? I'll gladly say, I'll pick something up on a machine that I don't own, and something I've never played before. And if I like it, that's great. But is it going to be the best thing ever? So just because something's on PC, which I'm primarily gaming on, because that's the only current generation machine I've got.
Yeah, fair enough.
At the moment, current generation format.
Yeah,
very easier to say. I'm not going to insist that that game is its best because it's not out on consoles yet. So,
yes.
all these things of I can I can tell Splatoon is a good game from looking at the videos, and I was watching it at EGX and it looked really nice. But whether it's actually a format seller, which I've seen people insist it is, and go, oh, this is the best game I've played in years. I'm not convinced of that.
The Wii U has had some quite high profile and quite good games out, but system sellers, working in retail, I haven't necessarily seen that many Wii U shipped.
So you would be in a better position than most, because when I was working at Electronics Boutique, which became Game, this was around the launch of the PS2, and the Dreamcast was already out, of course. It had been, it came out the previous year. it wasn't until I was behind the scenes in the shop that I realized how badly the Dreamcast was doing and how much ass the PlayStation was kicking against every single other format. When it came to N64 games, the only ones we would get big numbers of would be wrestling and Zelda or a Mario. You know, like Mario Party or, you know, something like that. Everything else, you'd get one or two copies of.
Yeah.
And, you know, say one of them would be for someone who ordered it and another two would be to go on the shelf and they would sit there. And with the Dreamcast, it would be, oh, we, you know, might get like 5 or 10 copies of Metropolis Street Racing. But when it came to the PlayStation, you would be getting 30, 40 copies of, you know, whatever it would be you know, coming out that week. And, yeah, retail, you can really see where, you know, all these formats are, you know, are selling. And, it wasn't, I was hopeful that the Dreamcast would hold on, but it wasn't until I got into the stock room and helped unpack the stock and put it on the shelf and see, you know, and saw how it sold, that I realized just how fucked
absolutely
Dreamcast was. And the brand loyalty, the number of people who just bought PS2s because it was the next PlayStation.
Yeah.
And that's mad.
Absolutely.
Because the launch games on the PS2 were bad.
I mean,
but people bought it because it was the next one.
And, you know, kind of people always kind of argue like, oh, yeah, like Nintendo's dead in the water. Oh, they're going to give up the, you know, game and all that type of thing. And I don't quite get that mentality of kind of wishing the competitors would, you know, basically just drown, in essence.
I think it would be a very bad thing. On Nintendo to go down. I don't want them to go.
No.
And that's coming from someone who, you know, I have a, you know, 3DS XL, and I can't say I'm that fond of it, and I don't have that many games. But I don't want them to go.
No.
And I just still don't have a Wii U. But I intend on getting one because there are games that I want to play. But to me, the cost of entry is still, you know, too high. And it was definitely too high on launch. It was murderously high on launch. It was suicide.
Fair enough.
But there's stuff I want to get because I like Nintendo as a developer. I like them as a company. And I want to play those games. So if those games disappeared, it's like it would be a sad day when Miyamoto
hangs
up his red or green cap.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm not looking forward to that day.
No.
Who knows, maybe he'll do it around the NX.
Okay.
Well, he is getting on, and he has been saying that he's been taking an increasingly, you know, backseat.
Absolutely, yeah.
Role
yeah.
on, you know, on development.
Hmm. Okay, I think I'm going to wrap up this section and quickly we'll be covering what we've been up to.
It's probably for the best.
Yeah. So, Cookie?
I've just been playing a little game. A little game called Batman Arkham Knight.
Batman!
I'm Batman. That's good. I've been quite getting into it, quite obsessed with it. Annoying everybody by posting videos on Facebook, which works wonders for you getting rid of people. It's good. There are a few bits. It's rock steady. It's got great combat. The story seems quite nicely put together. The new villain's quite interesting. The new version of Scarecrow's really cool. The only thing I don't like about it is the Batmobile.
You don't like the Batmobile?
No, they use it too much.
Hmm.
You feel forced to use it.
I think that's...
And that's annoying.
Yeah, that might be something to do with the push to next gen, because I remember hearing that the Batmobile was the reason behind a 360 and PS3 version and Wii U version not appearing. Because they wouldn't be able to do the, you know, the Batmobile on it.
It's well, like Batmobile, I just know it's a very big game.
It is a very big game, which is cool because of brand loyalty. I have owned every single Batman game that Warner Brothers has done over the last few years, including Origins, which I got burnt on. And I've enjoyed pretty much everyone, apart from Origins, which I got burned on.
But what did you like better. Origins?
I like the boss battles. The boss battles were better. Like the boss battle with Deathstroke. Mm. That was cool. It was a bit more varied of how you had to dispatch the bosses, which is cool. It's a shame they haven't actually brought that knowledge over to Arkham Knight. That's another thing. But for me, Arkham City is still my favourite.
Interesting.
I could still easily pick up Arkham City and play through that. Mm. Not having a problem with that. But no, it's just the little things like the Batmobile's just way overused. It feels like you're being forced to use it all the time.
Mm.
Even in the Riddler missions.
Yeah.
You have no choice but to use the Batmobile in some of them.
Admittedly, because we've got Batman Arkham Knight, and Emily put it on the other night, and she was having trouble actually controlling the Batmobile properly, and so she gave me the controller to do one of the Riddler things.
Mm.
I was like,
not the one of the races.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, with the changing of the course and whatnot, and
that's an example where I'd say they're definitely, you know, forcing the Batmobile down.
It's weird, the controls of the Batmobile, because there's no real brake.
Well, there is, but it's on an odd button for me. I'm playing on, because you know, I'll move my what I've been doing up, because I've been playing Batman.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine.
I'm playing with a 360, you know, wired pad.
Hmm.
And
it's X, isn't it?
It's X to do a pass turn.
Yeah.
And I keep forgetting that because it's, you know, I'd usually say, you know, it should be A or B.
Or even the left trigger.
Oh, yeah, even the left trigger would be, you know, a better choice. But no, it's on X. So I'm chasing, you know, things around the city.
Mm.
Or I'm doing the race courses.
Are you able to remap the controls?
You can, but I found it easier just to mow the pedestrians down, as they're thugs anyway, and just to crash through Gotham and destroy it.
Yeah, I'd say that's... Yeah.
It's a lot easier.
Now, I think I'm something like a quarter of the way through. Now I'm like 27,
28%. I'm 42% through at the moment.
Now, I would probably be beyond that if it wasn't for the fact that I wasn't playing on PC, and it seems to... Yeah, it's been, you know, at the porting house, it's been, right, we've put everything in there. Shall we optimize it? And someone says, what's that mean? That sounds like a big word. Optimize.
Let me just look,
like, does it run? And they say, well, technically it runs. Good enough. Out the door.
No, it's crazy.
I've got a PC, quad core, i5, with an AMD Radeon R9 280X graphics card with 3 GB of DDR5 RAM. And my main machine has got 8 GB of RAM. So automatically, you know, just out the gate, it's above and beyond PS4 and Xbox.
Yeah.
When it comes to spec, it's got, you know, more CPU grunt. It's got more graphics RAM. It's got more base RAM. So mine's got a total of 11 gigabytes to play about with, whereas an Xbone or a PS4, they've got about 5 gig to play about with by the time, you know, the OS is, you know, sitting there, because it, you know, you can never stop the OS on them. And it runs most of the time quite decently, but it's capped at 30 frames a second, which is not something I'm used to on a PC. And there are times, especially in the Batmobile, when I'm racing along, I've posted up a video, I'll have to see if I can find it, where I smash through, like, you know, some bins.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it's not like I'm going by anything that complicated. Just going down a road, and it pauses with the Batmobile in the air, the sound hung,
crikey,
for about 4 or 5 seconds.
That's crazy.
And I'm there with the controller, and I'm thinking, any time now, has this crashed? I think it might have crashed.
And no, it's slow-mo.
It just stutters into life again, and I'm playing it. And it does it far too often on the PC. I've got no idea what on earth they're doing. I really just think that they have it's not been optimised right.
Especially when it's run so smoothly on the consoles.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, the only problem I've had was the only time it's, touch wood, it's crashed on me so far is when I grappled and glided over a cliff right at the beginning, and I called the Batmobile just to see what would happen, and then I just hung in midair, stuck in the cliff with the Batmobile underneath me.
Whoops.
And I was just like, really? Come on.
But I mean, was that an actual lock?
Yeah, it was an actual lock. I had to restart it.
Oh, that reminds me. I have fallen through the earth.
Awesome.
I love it when that happens in a game.
Oh, dear.
And it didn't have a timeout on the death either, so Batman just kept falling and plummeting and plummeting, and there's Gotham City above him receding into the sky.
Oh.
And I'm going to have to quit this and reload it and hope it hasn't saved.
Yeah.
And it worked. But yeah, I've been enjoying it, but oh, Jesus. It's like someone's halved the spec on my PC.
Yeah. Which is annoying.
That's very definitely not a PC hardware problem. It's very definitely down to whoever's ported it.
Mm. And I think it's the same the other way around as well. When obviously a PC version of something runs far better than the console versions, it's not that the consoles can't handle it; it's that it's not optimized well enough for the consoles.
Yeah,
well, it can depend, but yeah, the current gen machines, if they're properly done, there's absolutely no reason.
Mm.
And I've heard all this stuff. Oh, it's about the varied hardware specs of the PC, and we have to test it on all these different versions. So, you're talking about the two main console formats this generation basically being cut down PCs in boxes.
Yeah.
And one of them uses DirectX. So, for fuck's sake, if you can get it running decently on an Xbox One, you can get it running decently on a PC.
Has there been anything else that you've been doing this week, Retroid?
I have been completing... we caught up with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 2.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Because Dave Internet noticed, he let me know, he's nice, he's Dave Internet, that Season 2 was on Netflix US.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
So we sat down and binged on those, and I think we'd previously got up to episode 8.
Okay.
So it was before a certain thing happens to Sky.
Hmm.
Yes.
And that's quite a decent season, isn't it, for the amount of shit that happens.
Definitely.
So there's things happening all over the place. All the things happen.
Hmm.
And there are people who get things happening to them, and then they can do all the things. So I really quite liked finishing up season 2 of that. And blimey, just thinking back to what that series started off like, you know, it was something like the first half of the first season, wasn't it? It was just thing of the week.
Hmm.
What's this thing? We have to go to a place and...
Most TV series start out like that, though, to be fair.
I know, but you could definitely feel when it changed...
Yeah.
It was because they were having to hold back. They had to time it so it would be Winter Soldier.
Mm.
And, yes, I could tell during the season where they had the Age of Ultron moment.
Yes.
But... there wasn't anything in the series that was critically relying on Age of Ultron.
No.
It was just something that was mentioned, and it was there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they made reference to the Ultron incident in such and such a place.
I was really, really pissed off when I actually watched that, episode that you're talking about, because we'd gone to see the Avengers Age of Ultron, almost as soon as it's out in the cinema.
Yeah.
And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 2 was delayed by probably about a month or so. So by the time we actually caught up, it was like, this makes so much more sense with the context of the movie now. It It really annoyed me how Age of Ultron started out. And to a certain extent, it does a little bit still with Tony Stark, you know, kind of giving up the, you know, suits of armor in, like, you know, the third film, and then suddenly he's there.
Like, so, what? Does Age of Ultron rely more on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I would say so, at least to begin with. Because it's not just like you know, mentioning that the Avengers, you know, are being assembled. It's also mentioning, I believe there was at least one line about Hydra having superpowers, or, you know, superhero people of their own.
Yeah.
Obviously, referring to Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, really annoying because, you know, it was kind of mistimed in the UK and it kind of ruined the, you know, ruined the surprise that it was kind of meant to be.
That was good old Channel 4, though, wasn't
it? Yeah.
Definitely.
Thanks, Channel 4. Screwing genre TV for the last few decades.
Okay.
I still remember when they put season 5 of Babylon 5 on at about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm. Doesn't surprise me. They fucked about with Babylon 5 like anything.
Yeah, let's see. I've also been watching Supernatural season 5, but I'll wait until next week with that. To discuss it with a resident Supernatural superfan.
Yep.
Definitely.
Cool. Let's see. The last thing I've been doing this week is... I think it was last week that there was all the thing about a small developer who produced a game called Sunset.
Okay.
Saying they were stopping producing PC games because they just weren't selling enough. Because as it was, Sunset, which up until this point I hadn't really heard of.
No.
Had been kickstarted. And then it went on general sale. And it proceeded to sell around about 4,000 copies.
Wow.
And I think most of those were Kickstarter backers. So in other words, it sort of flopped out and then sat there.
Okay.
And there was all this you know, Gamergate going on about it because, as I found out, Leigh Alexander wrote some of the story for it.
Okay.
And it's like, oh, right, it'll be because ethics. So that's why Gamergate were banging on about it, because I just saw that and I thought, oh, Gamergate are angry about it. I must have a look at this game. It's probably good. but, you know, I watched the trailer and I read up about it, and as it is, it's not really a game.
Okay.
But, you know, I thought, oh, you know, it was about you know, a tenner or something like that. And I thought, well, for something that's not really a game, that's a bit much. Yeah. But Humble Bundle did a Leading Ladies pack.
Hey, right.
And there it was as one of the top tier games. Cool. And I thought, right, okay, I'll buy it then. Because for the price of, you know, what Sunset were asking for in the first place on Steam, I get several other games that I was already wanting. That's good. That's, you know, that's a deal.
Hmm.
So I installed it on my PC, and I thought, you know, I'll give it a go. I'll see how it is. And I completed it over 2 evenings. The story of it is it's in the early 70s in a fictional South American country, and this American woman is employed as a cleaner for this, you know, government minister.
Yeah.
This, you know, he's basically just, you know, one of the paper pushers. And she's employed to go to his apartment while he's out at sunset, hence the name. And just, you know, complete the little tasks that you're told, you know, like do the washing, ironing, you know, maybe cook a meal or something like that, unpack some boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for each of these little things, you can react entirely as it's said. You know, you can unpack the one example would be you've got a pile of books and he leaves you a note saying, please sort these. Now you can put them in alphabetical order, or you can do the more playful one, which is to rearrange them in color. And you can do all these little things, and add a little bit of personality, and he'll leave notes to you, and you can reply either coldly, or you can reply, you know, a bit playfully.
Yeah.
Now, this goes on for, you know, weeks and weeks, because you go, you know, once a week. And it started to develop this, almost, you know, a romance, even though you never meet him. Between the notes he leaves, your responses, and the changes that you make to his apartment. And the notes he leaves in return for that. And as everything's going on, the character's brother is leading the resistance against the government, which is, you know, despotic, because it's South America in the 70s, so it's going to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you can push Ortega, who you're working for, to maybe give some more information, you know, leave some information out so you can copy it down.
Yeah.
And then send it to the rebels. And that can help them. And then he'll leave a note saying, are we doing the right thing? And you can leave a note saying, you know, everything's the right wing, you know, the right thing to do if it feels right.
Hmm.
You know, all these things. And it develops and develops and develops. The country eventually goes to war, but you're still just going to the apartment and doing these little things. And Ortega ends up hoarding artworks that he's having to rescue because the government has shut down the opera and museums. And you can say, oh, yeah, get, you know, get more, or, you know, we can't fit any more in the apartment.
Yeah.
And, well, it basically ends up, and I'm not sure how much you can manipulate it, but in my playthrough, yeah, as in, you probably can't much, but in my playthrough, the revolution succeeded. And this woman who is an American student, I should, if I didn't say that to start off with, you know, ends up falling in love with this Ortega and moving into his apartment.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's got gamey elements, as in you wander around the apartment in first person perspective, and there are things you can choose to do. One example is you can choose to play the piano. He has a grand piano, and you can choose to accept his offer to, you know, leave instruction booklets out so you can, you know, play it. And yeah, every evening you go there, and, you know, the certain tasks can take certain amounts of time, and you've only got the hour, but you can choose to either learn a folk song, a traditional folk song of the country, or the anthem of the revolutionaries. Just little things like that. And cool. I just really enjoyed it because it's an interactive story that you wander around and you can manipulate certain things in the environment. And it's quite stylized, but yeah, it's quite nice. I completed it. I'm glad I, you know, got it. And I can understand it's not very commercial. I can understand why you didn't sell that many, but I'm very glad I own it and I'm glad I played it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's fair enough.
Okay. And, awesome. Yeah, I'll just do a quick bit of mine. I've been playing Grand Theft Auto 5 for the PS4. Cool. I'm kind of looking forward to when the Movie Maker type thing is released for it in an update. That's going to be quite cool. The one thing that I found with Grand Theft Auto 5 is that I've been able to kind of play further into the story mode of it than I have with the previous GTAs. And I'm not entirely sure whether that's necessarily because you've got three characters to choose from, so you can, you know, obviously got quite a range of different types of kind of lifestyle that you could, you know, kind of peruse and whatnot. Or whether it's only now that I figured out that if you're kind of stuck in the story because you don't know how to progress it, go home. Because what I've found is that, you know, every time, you know, I've kind of gone to turn off the console, I've been like, okay, well, I should save. I can save on the, you know, mobile phone kind of version for a little bit of it. Yeah. But I decided to kind of go to, like, say, for example, Michael's house, you know, kind of sleep in the bed in order to save that way. And every time I do that, I get through the front door and a cutscene plays and I end up having to do, like, a mission somewhere. So it's like, ah, so that's how it works. Okay.
Who's your favourite character?
So far, I think it has to be Michael. Just because he's kind of both kind of smooth and slightly suave and whatnot. I mean, when he actually kicks somebody out of the car, he doesn't actually physically pull them or anything. He just opens the door and then, like, you know, sticks his thumb out and is like, out, kind of thing. And they do. It's like, brilliant. I think my second favourite character is Franklin. And Trevor's my third favourite character, although I do like the character of him.
I know what you mean. Franklin is very definitely the one to just go mad with. Whereas it feels a bit wrong to go on rampages with Michael or Franklin.
Yeah.
But Trevor? Yeah. Just blow the shit out of everything. It's perfectly in fitting with his character.
I think one of the first missions, proper missions, that you actually play with him, there's like an interesting thing where, you know, sort of like you start off where you know, you're kind of having sex with a lady, and it turns out to be some other guy's, you know, kind of girl, and then you end up beating the guy up and whatnot. And one of the people that are with was with Trevor was kind of saying about how, oh, we should have done something to the girl. And it's like, you know, and basically Trevor was kind of responding to that, and it's like, don't be so disrespectful to women, which is kind of nice.
He has a very weird moral compass.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I love how all the absolutely mental plans in the game are all his.
Yeah.
They're not really thought out more beyond, can we do this?
Mm. Absolutely. I've done some of the missions with him taking out the bikers, and it's like he is literally one person against a massive, you know, group of bikers, and it takes me, you know, 7, 8, 9 times to kind of figure out how to actually approach the mission.
Yeah,
it's so good. I haven't dared go online yet. I'm kind of waiting until I fully complete the single player before going online. But I did learn that because Emily has PS Plus. Yeah. I should be able to play online.
Yes,
even though I don't have it.
That's how it works with
PS4. So I'm kind of looking forward to that as well.
Cool.
Yeah, and that's most of what I've been doing. I think that's all we've got time for today. So it's goodbye from...
It's goodnight from me, Paul Wood. I'm Super Retroid on Twitter and Retroid on Eurogamer.net, and I have frame rate issues.
It's good night for me, Paul, aka 100_cookie on Twitter.
It's good night for me, Paul Blewett. I'm on Twitter as @PaulBlewett. You can find the show notes over at www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. Do tweet at us. We like reading out tweets. You can also find us on Facebook and Google Plus as Nerds Assemble Podcast.
Or Paulcast.
Yes, Paulcast. Yes.
Or the Batmans.
The Batmen. Yes.
Yeah, Batman.
Excellent. And good night.